The following lecture is provided by Biblical Training. The speaker is Dr. George Guthrie. More information is available at www.biblicaltraining.org.
Think you'll find that this will go by quickly. We'll have a good time. I want our class to be very interactive. What we will do, the normal process of the class, will be to move from, especially after we get into the text of Hebrews, we're going to deal with unit by unit, especially with Hebrews. You have to stay in touch with where you are in the book and what's going on and how it fits with what's around it. And as we go through, we'll go verse by verse through the unit. And then at the end, after we discern what the text means, we're going to talk about practical implications of that. I want us to over and over and over again say, okay, what's the significance of this as we bring it to our world where we live today in terms of our personal lives, in terms of our life in the church? Talk an awful lot about that. How do you bring this truth to bear on how we live today in the 21st century? Okay, so we're gonna do that. I want to get to know you this week, these 2 weeks. My family is here, and they're going to be having lunch with me most days, but you're welcome to join us for lunch if you'd like to do that, and we can talk about all kinds of things, not just Hebrews, if you want to do that. So we'll have a good time with that. Let me introduce myself, and then I want to go through and take roll and get to know you just a little bit, and then when we get into our study itself, we're going to have to really keep moving. You're going to have to listen quickly in this class for us to get everything in that we need to. We have a lot of ground to cover, but we'll have a good time along the way. Also, normally what we will do is we will take breaks mid-morning, somewhere around 10:30 probably, then at noon for lunch, and then in the afternoon we'll take a brief break at about 2:05, 2:10, somewhere in there depending on where we are. And probably we'll let you out a little bit before 3:30. We'll see how our time goes, but we'll probably let you make up those minutes that you didn't get off for normal break time and get on with your day and go do other things like play racquetball and, you know, things like that that you're going to have a lot of time to do in the next 2 weeks. So, but we'll have a good time together. I am a professor at Union University. Union is a liberal arts Southern Baptist university in Jackson, Tennessee. It happens to be the oldest Southern Baptist institution in the United States. It was founded in the 1820s originally in its original form, and it is a school that is connected to broader evangelicalism. It's also very passionate about its Baptist heritage and also about being overtly Christian in what we do. So it's a great atmosphere, very strong school academically. In our area, we have a little over 200 students majoring in Christian studies and about 12 faculty members right now. So it's a great place to be. It's a lot of fun to be there. My family and I live on 5.5 acres out in the country north of Jackson. We have a pond. We have ducks with no name in our front yard. We have catfish that I stock the pond with. We have a Labrador retriever that does not like to get in the water. And we have two cats named Abby and Sox. And so we have a good time living out there. We have blueberries and fruit trees and things like that. I enjoy a lot of different things. We helped plant a church 10 years ago. Most of those 10 years, I've been co-pastor of that church. I've been on a sabbatical for the last year and a half from leadership in the church. A colleague of mine actually became the lead pastor of the church about a year and a half ago, and that's been a wonderful time for us. I love sushi. I enjoy eating various kinds of food, but I love Oriental food and just enjoy being with my family. And my son and I are doing a mini basketball camp while I'm here. He's 11. He's just starting to play basketball, so he and I are going to be practicing basketball every afternoon after class. And any of you are welcome to come join us. I'm horribly out of shape at this point. I broke my ankle a year ago and was climbing a tree to get a cat out of a tree. I'm very embarrassed to say that, but it's actually an exercise in humility to admit that my brother said, next time the cat gets up the tree, shoot the cat out of the tree. And I heard all kinds of jokes like, you know, have you ever seen a skeleton of a cat in a tree? No, and that kind of thing. So, but I'm in the process of starting to work toward getting back in shape, and my son and I will be there. And if any of you want to come and shoot ball with us, you're welcome to do that. So that's a little bit about me. My involvement with Hebrews started when I was a PhD student wannabe. I was actually taking German at the time and was assigned to translate an article by August Strobel on the Psalm foundation of what's going on there in Hebrews chapter 5, verses 7 and 8, right in there, where it talks about Jesus crying and shedding tears and that type of thing. And Strobel raised the question, where does this come from? Because we don't see it in the gospel accounts. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to it. But he was dealing with the psalm basis of some of this material that we have in Hebrews chapter 5. So I became interested in Hebrews and became interested in the use of the psalms in Hebrews. When I went to Trinity Divinity School to do a Master of Theology, I focused my thesis on the use of Psalm 110:1 in the book of Hebrews. And we're going to see that Psalm 110:1 is used 5 times. It's quoted once in 113, and it's alluded to 4 other times. And so as I studied those different uses through Hebrews, they're spread throughout the book. So when you ask the question, how does this function in Hebrews, you're studying a structure question, a whole discourse question. And you've got to look at the whole discourse in order to be able to answer that. So I looked at the structure of the book and started investigating the structure of the book. I found that that was a very difficult question, and was there was a lot of discussion about that and no real consensus about that. So I focused on that issue as I tried to answer that question. And my professors there at Trinity encouraged me to expand that and do my PhD work on the structure of Hebrews, which I did, and that was my dissertation. The dissertation was published by E.J. Brill in the Novum Testamentum Supplement series originally, and eventually was republished in a form that people could actually afford by Baker Books. It cost, I think, about $90 in the monograph form with Brill, $16.99 with Baker Books, so that actually became much more affordable for people. And then in the last few years have done various things. I did the Hebrews section in the Illustrated Backgrounds Commentary for Hebrews. Before that, I did the book that you're using in this class, the NIV Application Commentary, which I was very excited about because I was wanting to take a lot of the rigorous study I'd done on Hebrews and bring it down to address the Christian life and the church. And so that's what I tried to do in the commentary that you're going to be using over these next 2 weeks. This last spring and summer, I did the study notes for the NLT Study Bible. Tyndale is going to come out with a second version of the New Living Translation, kind of a 2.0. And when that comes out, and they're going to have a number of study tools that will go with it, and one of those will be the NLT Study Bible. And I did the introduction and the study notes for that. And then more recently, I've been working on things like a commentary on James that will be coming out in the new Expositor's Bible Commentary. And I'm currently working to finish a commentary on the use of the Old Testament in Hebrews that's going to be published in a big one-volume commentary by Carson and Beale. Greg Beale and Don Carson are doing a big reference tool which tracks the uses of every Old Testament quotation or allusion in the New Testament. So I'll say more about that because we're going to deal a little bit with some of that material even this morning. So that's a little bit of my involvement in Hebrews, but I have never gotten tired of this book. I am passionate about it. And in the past year, in studying things like the echoes in Hebrews, which we'll talk about a little bit, I've felt the joy of discovery all over again about things that I've never seen before in Hebrews, new discoveries that I'm making. And that's one thing that's exciting to me about God's Word is it's deep and it's rich. It's not something you're ever going to get down completely. There's always a lot more there to study. Let's take a look at the syllabus and look at the processes of the course here, what we're going to try to accomplish. And y'all also call this delusions of grandeur. So let's kind of go over this a little bit. Let me give you a couple of things at the end in terms of contact information. And I want to give you one option here just to ask if you'd like to break things up in the course just a little bit. You can read the course description and course objectives. The textbook and supplemental reading, you do need to have the NIV application commentary. And then I also want you to have Lane's commentary. Now, there are two reasons why I got you to go ahead and get Lane. One is for use in this class, so you can use it kind of as we go along, especially you're assigned to read that introductory section of Lane. But also, Lane is one of the two best commentaries out there on Hebrews. It's going to be a commentary that will serve you for the rest of your life. Lane and then Attridge's commentary in the Hermeneus series are just the two best commentaries in terms of English language commentaries on the book of Hebrews. There are a lot of other good ones out there that have been coming on the scene, but those are really the two best. I don't like the format of the Word Biblical Commentary. It's like they got together and said, how can we make this as confusing as possible in terms of the way that they interact with the text and that kind of thing. But Lane's commentary is substantive. He was a wonderful evangelical scholar. Bill was my mentor for about 10 years, and he died of cancer about 5 years ago. He was a godly man and a wonderful scholar on the book of Hebrews. When his commentary first came out back in the early 90s, it was the focus of a section at the Society of Biblical Literature where all these scholars, world-class scholars, got up and commented on his commentary, and they just gave glowing reviews because it was so thorough. In fact, he includes a section on my work, which my dissertation was just finished. He was the outside reader for my dissertation and had included about 19 pages on my material in his introduction, and one of the guys who was commenting on his commentary in that session said, and it's so up to date. Here's a 1990, you know, whatever dissertation right here. And it just came out. And Bill was sitting up there and he winked at me, you know, and he was a great guy. But that'll be a commentary you'll be able to use for the rest of your life. It's really wonderful and very, very, very rich. I do want you to have your reading done prior to coming to class. You'll see overlap between what you'll read in the commentary sum and the material that I will present in class, and yet that will be reinforcement. So I want you to read prior to coming to class, have that read, keep up with your reading, because I will ask for a percentage of your reading at the end of the term. So probably what you want to do as you go through and do your reading is make a note of that in your syllabus, and say, you know, I did get this reading finished, all right? Also, the Biblical Greek Exegesis book, I want you to follow a standard process of exegesis like the material in the latter half of that book. You don't have to use that book, but I want you to follow a good, solid process of exegesis. And as we go on, I want us to interact individually about your paper that you want to do, and I'll say more about that in just a minute. Okay, requirements for the class. Notice that there are penalties for missed class, and just you need to be very aware of that. I'll give you contact information in just a minute. If an emergency comes up and you need to get in touch with me, I'll give you some ways that you can do that. The exam for the class, what I have down is that we would do one final exam. Now let me tell you what I'm open to us doing. I'm open to us taking a midterm exam on Monday morning and breaking up the material in that way. The final will still be somewhat comprehensive, but it will force you to go ahead and get into the material and really process the material as you go along. So I'm open to taking the first hour or so Monday morning and doing a midterm exam that will help you go ahead and process the material. How many of you would be interested in doing a midterm on Monday morning? Let me see a show of hands. The exams are going to be, for the most part, essay type exams. and I'll prepare you for them. What I tend to do with the exams is I tend to craft them in the mode of some situation you might come up with in church. You know, deacon from your church comes to you and says, here's a passage that's dealing with this. I don't understand what's going on here. Will you explain this to me? That kind of thing. So, but I'm also going to have a section of material that is more objective. That's also very objective, but some things to make sure that you're tracking what's going on, where the stuff is in Hebrews as you work through the various chapters of Hebrews. So it is a lot of ground to cover. And if we wait until a final exam, it's a lot to assimilate. The other side of it is, a positive thing about a class like this is everything is so compressed over a 2-week period, it's all fresh. And so if we would rather wait and do just one final exam at the very end, and you know, just use all of that time to really kind of keep up with your notes and study. I can tell you, if you wait till the last minute to study for it, it will overwhelm you. So you've got to study as you go along. So why don't you think about it, and maybe after a break today we can talk about it again, and maybe you can have a chance to talk among yourselves at the break time. But the exam is going to be very objective. It will be coming right out of the notes. I'm not going to ask you kind of esoteric questions from the commentary. If you remember, footnote 59 on page 36 dealt with blank. You know, we're not going to do that. And I'll prepare you for the exam and give you, you know, a good idea of what's going to be on the test. Because my point is to have you learn the material. I mean, that's what an exam is. An exam is a form of reinforcing what you're learning in the class. That's all it is. So we'll take an exam there at least at the end, and we'll think through what we need to do prior to that. Again, with your reading assignments, get those done prior to class. Translation work for each day. If you'll look at your course schedule, which is the last sheet of paper you have there on your syllabus, you have a block of text in parentheses every day with a little book symbol out to the left of it. That's what you're assigned to translate for the class. So what I want you to do is I want you to translate that. I want you to be ready to talk about syntax issues. I'm not going to blow you out of the water with that, but what I want you to do is I want you to be in the Greek text yourself. As we work our way through the course, I will do a lot of reading of the Greek text, and we'll comment on grammar and syntax and things like that as we go through. But I want you to stretch a little bit. That's part of the purpose of this course. And kind of, you know, stretch with me and make sure that you're in the text itself. Hebrews is not easy Greek. It's pretty tough stuff. It uses lots of participles and things like that. But I want you to do your best to come prepared with that portion of Scripture. And I'll have volunteers translate and that kind of thing when we get to that passage. All right. Your research project may be done in one of the following forms: an exegetical research paper on a passage approved by the professor, or a theological research paper on a topic approved by the professor. The theological study should focus on the theological role of the motif in Hebrews, but it should also cover the background of the concept in the Old Testament, the broader New Testament, and significance for the contemporary Christian. So, for instance, if you took a motif like faith, or a very, very, very difficult one like rest, which I think somebody emailed me about, that's a tough one. In fact, I just did a paper recently on that at the Society of Biblical Literature, and we'll talk more about that. But if you want to choose some theological motif, high priesthood, blood sacrifice, something like that, you're welcome to do that. Those are a little more difficult to do well because you've got to make sure that you're covering all of your bases. Now, in terms of the exegesis paper, what you're going to want to do is choose a passage that's somewhere around no more than 4 to 6 verses, because you cannot do a good exegesis paper if it is longer than that. The papers, in terms of length, Chris, I forget exactly what we did last time. Normally, in a master's level kind of course, I would expect a paper of at least 15 to 20 pages. What I want you to do is to do a good, solid exegesis, where you're going in and you're dealing with the text, you're interacting with secondary literature, but you're also interacting with the text yourself, where you're reflecting on the relationships, word relationships, phrase relationships, that kind of thing in the paper. And then bringing it down to, okay, here are key principles in this passage, and here's how we make the step to application. One of the things I'll try to model for you over and over and over again in this class is, how do you move from exegesis, where you are identifying what the text means, to appropriate application of the passage? When I wrote the commentary, the NIV application commentary, the hardest part of that commentary for me in some ways was the bridging the context sections. Because with every passage you had to say, okay, what are the principles that guide how you do sound application here? And you have interesting places like Hebrews 9 verses 1 through 10, where the whole point of the passage is that the Old Testament form of worship is no longer valid. So how do you take something where the whole point of it is that this is no longer valid and then move to appropriate application in a new covenant context? How do you do that? So we're going to talk about that a good bit, and I want you to incorporate that process in your paper as well. You notice the seminary's grading scale will be adopted in the course, and then your percentages of your final grade are given there. And then you have your course schedule there, as I mentioned just a moment ago, and we will try to stick with this as we go through. There's a little bit of flexibility there, but we're going to try to stay with it as we work our way through the book. Now, let me emphasize again that for me, something that is very, very, very important to me and important in my philosophy of education is the concept of community. Now, we don't have time to build a lot of community here in 2 weeks, but you'll be surprised, how the class will gel, and you've had that experience before in other classes. It is very important to me that when we do, quote, Christian education in any form, that we incorporate in that concepts of community. And what that means is that this is relational. And so I want you to feel free to talk to me, set up a time to get with me. That's why I'm here, is to spend time with you. And you're not intruding on our family time. My family understands, and we're going to get lots of time together while we're here as well. So feel free to contact me, and let's get together for lunch or supper or something like that. Now, at times, people will say, well, you know, Christian community is supposed to have lots of grace, right, Prof? I mean, we've got to have grace, you know, in Christian community. And my response to that is, yes, and grace is sometimes forming as well as forgiving. And so what grace does at times is give us what we need. So I'm going to be tough with you in terms of the requirements of the course and want us to work hard at this. But at the same time, I want to hear what's going on in your life. And if you have some crisis come up, I want to be sensitive to that and work with you in that. So we'll do that as we go along. All right, anybody have a question about the syllabus? Yeah, Hexen?
One, under reading assignments, student will read all of Guthrie commentary according to the portion of Hebrews assigned.
Yeah.
Is that all of the commentary, or just read parts of the commentary along with what's assigned?
Yeah, what you're going to do is the whole commentary will be covered by the end. Okay. But for instance, in your course schedule you have there at the back, for today you have 1-1 through 2-4, so technically you will have needed to, you know, read all of the commentary for that portion, you know, right away, and then for next time to go all the way through 3:19 in the commentary. All right, so what you want to do is prior to the class, you want to have read the corresponding material in the commentary all the way to that point. So it's a good amount of ground to cover, but it's readable material, you know. So that's one of the things about a compressed 3-hour course. You've got a lot of ground to cover in a short amount of time. Tell me, in terms of your research projects here at Southern, what do you normally do in terms of length? What would be an average length? Watching, yeah. Lying is a sin. Okay.
10 to 15 years. Yeah. Somewhere 10 to 15.
Yeah. I think on this type of project, you know, to me, like I said, normally I would say 15 would be pretty short. I mean, it's my students at Union in an upper level course will normally do a 12 to 15 page, you know, research paper. And I think you're going to have a hard time doing a solid job with this, you know, any shorter than that. So what I'll leave it with you as is I think, let's say a minimum of 12 to 15. And don't go nuts with this. I mean, you know, obviously you could write 40 pages on this type of project. But so you have to economize, use your space well. But let's just say that, you know, I'm not going to count you down if you do a 12 to 15 page paper, as long as you do it well. That's the key. So I'm not judging them and kind of holding them like this, say, oh, that's about a C there, you know. I'm not going to take that form of grading. You know, I want you to do it well. And let me give you a hint. If you can, while I'm here, if you go ahead and you start working on that, doing an outline of that, the more you can talk through with me in person, the better. Because I can look at, for instance, an introduction and tell you almost immediately if you're on track with what you're doing. Let me give you one hint, a mistake that people make a lot of times in exegesis papers, is if you're dealing with historical background as a part of your introduction, normally in an introduction, you're going to try to set the context in some way. If you're dealing with historical and literary contexts, literary context is pretty obvious. You're saying, okay, this is where this passage fits in the book. Historical context, people struggle with a little bit more because they want to go into, let's talk about the problem of the authorship of Hebrews. You don't want to do that. What you want to do is, in terms of historical context, you want to only address the historical backdrop as it touches on the passage with which you are dealing. All right? So if you're dealing with blood sacrifice, you want to do a brief introduction to the context of the sacrificial system in broader Judaism, both Old Testament and perhaps, you know, the New Testament era. But the author of Hebrews is mostly oriented to the Old Testament text. That's what the author of Hebrews is dealing with. All right. So you want to set the historical context a little bit in that way, rather than trying to go into date. Do not go into a treatment of the date and authorship and all of that of Hebrews. You don't have space to do that in this type of paper. Okay. All right. Other questions? Yes.
You say that we're to turn in our translations at the end of the course. Is that correct?
That's right.
Are you wanting us to follow the way it's done in biblical Greek exegesis?
Yeah. What I would say is, if you will do your translation, what you ought to do as you're processing a translation anyway is jot notes that, you know, kind of help you think through the syntax of the passage, for instance. Okay? And so I'm not looking for anything other than to see that you did a good job of interacting with the Greek text. So I want you to come out with a smooth translation, that's your own translation. But also, I think it would be good for you to go ahead and jot notes that will show me that you interacted with the text in a meaningful way. Okay. You know, I don't want you to do a paraphrase of the New American Standard. I want to see that you did, you know, work there and that you kind of track with that. Now, you guys are going to be at different levels in terms of your Greek ability. I understand that. So what I want to see is that you are interacting with it the best you can at the level at which you are. And so I want to see a written out. I'm more interested in a written out type of translation. You don't have to type this up. You can write it out and then write your notes as long as we can read what you're doing there. All right, any final questions before we get to it? I want us to have a word of prayer together, and to kind of lead into that, what I want us to do is to hear a quote from St. Thomas Aquinas, and then I'll lead us in a prayer. Aquinas wrote this, very appropriate for a seminary student and for a professor as well. Lord, give me a sharp sense of understanding, a retentive memory, and the ability to grasp things correctly and fundamentally. Grant me the talent of being exact in my explanations and the ability to express myself with thoroughness and charm. Point out the beginning, direct the progress, and help in the completion. All right, very good prayer from Thomas Aquinas. Let's have a word of prayer together. Father, we thank you for the opportunity to be here in this class. Lord, it's going to be an exercise in discipline. It's going to be rigorous. We're all going to be very tired by the end of each day, I'm sure. And yet, Lord, we are dealing with your word. And so I pray that you would energize us by your Spirit, that you would energize our gifts, that you would guide our interaction with one another, that you would quicken our minds. Lord, that we would keep things in perspective here, that this is not simply about academic exercise. This is also about the exercise of the heart and the exercise of the community and the church. And we pray that, Lord, you would constantly bring to our minds the things that we need to think through in terms of how to live well in Christian community in these days. And so I pray that you would bless our conversation, bless the study that we're going to do together. I pray for each of these gentlemen who are in this class. I pray that, Lord, you would bless their lives, that you would help them with the things that are going on outside of this class, whether it's ministry or family situations or work. Lord, that you would give them strong support as they are really persevering through these 2 weeks. And we ask these things in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we want to begin by taking a look at the background of the book of Hebrews. Now, we're not going to have time to go in near the detail that you're going to read about in Lane's commentary. I want to give you one other source here, and Chris, if you can help me by passing these out. This is an article that I wrote this past year for a book called The Face of New Testament Studies. This is going to be the chapter on recent research in the book of Hebrews. It's called Hebrews in its First Century Context. And what I did in this is I went through and I kind of took a concentric circles approach where I looked at the whole Greco-Roman world. I looked at broader Judaism of the first century. I looked at emergent Christianity. And what I did is I talked about research going on Hebrews that fits each one of those contexts. Now, this isn't an assignment, but I want you to have this as a resource because, especially for those of you who are going to go on and maybe do some work on Hebrews, this will give you a pretty up-to-date kind of thing in terms of a lot of the research that's been done even in the last few years. Now, let me say to you that this is a rough copy. This has gone through a couple of editorial reviews with Baker Bookhouse. So you're going to have some typos in here, which is not a big deal. This is kind of the rough version of it, but this is the only version that I have at this point. And so I wanted to go ahead and provide this for you just so you can have an extra resource there. Let's take a look at the backdrop of the book of Hebrews. In terms of the backdrop, we want to take a look at various things like authorship and recipients and things like this. Now, you guys have read, I think just about everybody has read that introduction. Is that right? You didn't do a pre-reading there. Okay. That's my fault for not kind of getting that to you. But let me start with a kind of a fictional reading that I included at the beginning of the commentary. And what I want you to do is just to imagine this in your mind's eye as a creative thing that pulls together what the original context of Hebrews might have been. Okay, let me read this to you, and then we're going to get into the specifics of authorship and date and backdrop and that type of thing. Antonius sat alone in a deteriorating second-story apartment located in a slum on the slope of Esquiline Hill in Rome. As rain pelted the age-worn wall outside, a plate of bread and vegetables and a cup of sour wine rested on the makeshift table. The room had turned dark with the coming of this storm, and Antonius lit a small oil lamp against the gloom. With the light, hungry cockroaches materialize, scampering to the dark safety of cracks in the wall. In the apartment next door, a baby cried and the infant's father screamed obscenities at the infant's mother. An urgent conversation rose and then faded as an unseen pair of business partners walked down the stairs. Somewhere in the muddy streets below, a unit of Roman soldiers marched past, driven under sharp orders from its commander. And Antonius sat alone, thinking. That morning, his employer, a rough, burly fellow named Brutus, once again turned from the task of pricing fruits and vegetables to ridicule this young Christian. The verbal jabs had become as annoying as gnats darting to and fro in the shop's pungent air. Brutus was big, obnoxious, and cruel. Antonius cringed against the man's emotional blows, wishing he could strike back out of his hurt and embarrassment. Each time he turned the other cheek, it received a slap in kind. Yet he bit his lip, nursed his wounded pride, and again asked the Lord's forgiveness for his thoughts. Persecution of the church in Rome had yet to result in martyrdom, but since the expulsion of Jews under the Emperor Claudius, Christians had continued to be harassed to various degrees by both Jews and pagans. Upon the expulsion, some had suffered imprisonment, beatings, and the seizure of their properties. That was almost 15 years ago now. Antonius had not been part of the Christian church at that time, but had heard about the conflict. In fact, his own grandfather, ruler of the synagogue of the Augustenses, had been one of the most outspoken opponents of the Christians. When at 17 Antonius converted to Christianity, the old man almost died, declaring Antonius dead in a shouting match that ended in tears and a tattered relationship. In recent months, abuse of the church had escalated with the amused approval of the emperor himself, and now emotional fatigue was taking its toll. Footsteps in the hall, a scream in the night, meaningless events that nevertheless set Antonius's heart racing. He had been told the cost of following the Messiah, but somehow his experience was different than he expected. In the beginning, he thought his joy would never be broken, that he would always feel the presence of God. He had been taught the Lord, the righteous judge, would vindicate his new covenant people. Did not the scriptures, speaking of the Messiah, say that God had put all things in subjection under his feet? But the church had taken a great beating lately. And members of its various house groups had become discouraged and were questioning whether Christ was really in control. In their hearts, they wondered if God had closed his ears against their cries for relief. Some, in their disillusionment, doubted and left the church altogether. Antonius Bar David remembered the traditions of the synagogue and the support of the Jewish community, the joy of the festivals, and the solemn celebrations of the Jewish calendar. He appreciated the fellowship of Christ's community, but genuinely missed the traditions of his ancestors, and he missed members of his family. He watched them from a distance as they walked together to market by the Tiber River. Some of them still would not speak to him and passed him on the street as they would a Gentile. That was very difficult. And today, his loneliness closed in around him like a dark, damp blanket. To make matters worse, he was one of the poorer members of the church. When Antonius became a Christian, he lost his job as a tailor's apprentice in the Jewish quarter. He now spent his days sorting rotting produce, sweeping the floor, swatting flies, and receiving orders from obnoxious Roman slaves shopping for rich mistresses. He stooped so low as to take pieces of rotten fruit home to supplement his meager food supply. Even rich men's slaves fared better. Early in the week, Gaius, the kitchen slave of an equestrian who lived in the area, tossed him a handful of overripe figs, saying, "Here, Christian, change your cannibalistic diet by taking a bit of good fruit." Laughter hung with the gnats in the air. To be poor and a Christian invited double portions of ridicule. Antonius had missed the weekly meal in worship for the past 2 weeks, and his heart had cooled somewhat toward the little house group. A spiritual itch in the back of his spirit warned him, cautioning him concerning his loss of perspective. Yet in recent days, he had begun to snuff such thoughts from his mind as quickly as they came. Antonius's bitterness over his current circumstances was growing and slowly obscuring the truth. That night, the believers were to meet for worship and encouragement. Rumor had it the leaders had received a document from back east somewhere, and although discouraged and tempted to skip the meeting again, Antonius's curiosity was aroused, and he decided to travel the short distance to the neighborhood house at which the fellowship was to meet. Entering the gathering room, he spoke greetings to several friends who also looked tired from the day's work. The hostess offered something to drink and friendly banter, but dejection hung like a cloud over the room. When the meal was finished, the group's leader, a good and godly man of almost 70 years, finally arrived. Joseph was a bit out of breath, having come from a meeting with the other leaders halfway across the city. He was visibly moved as he stood smiling before the group of about 20, his hand shaking slightly from advancing age. After a few words of introduction, Joseph took a deep breath and explained he had talked the other leaders into allowing his group the first reading of the scroll. With a twinkle in his eye, the elder said, "I believe you will find this quite relevant." He unrolled the first part of the parchment and began reading with vigor. "In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by a Son." Okay, hopefully, what that little reading does is it pulls you in a bit to what may have been the original situation of Hebrews. It's very hard when we deal with backgrounds kinds of issues to be dogmatic about a book like Hebrews, because the book itself doesn't tell us specifically who wrote it, when it was written, to whom it was written. So we have to kind of look for clues within the book in order to find out the possible backdrop for the book. But what I want to tell you from the very beginning is this, that Hebrews was not simply written as a theological treatise. It is that. It is deep and rich, highly theological in its orientation. But it was not simply written as a theological treatise that would be interesting to people. It was not merely meant for us 2,000 years later to dissect and to try to come up with a concise overview of the theology of the book. It was written in the crucible of a pastoral situation. It was written out of a motive to give strong encouragement to those who were struggling in the Christian life. And if we don't tune in to that right from the very beginning, then we are beginning to miss really the impact of Hebrews. There are those who suggest, like David DeSilva, who's a friend of mine, he has a book on perseverance as well as a socio-rhetorical commentary on Hebrews. And if I'm remembering correctly, David says, well, these people weren't really struggling with, you know, falling back into mainstream of Judaism. This is just more of a rhetorical kind of thing the author is doing. I don't think so. I think the author is dealing with a group of people who are struggling. They're across a spectrum spiritually. We're going to talk about this. It's like when you minister in a church and you look out on that church, you can't look into the hearts of everybody there. And there are people in your congregation, some who are walking with the Lord in a solid way. They are being used in ministry. They have a dynamic sense of closeness to the Lord. They are in the Word. They are people of prayer. All the way to the other end of the spectrum, to that person who's sitting out there, and they are just teetering on the edge of walking away from the church and perhaps even walking away from Christianity. And I think that's the kind of situation that the author of Hebrews is dealing with. He's dealing with that very real pastoral kind of situation. All right, let's take the kind of the main background issues here one at a time and look at them. Let's first look at authorship. Who was the author of the book? Let's do an overview of these background kinds of issues. Most of the New Testament books, as you know, tell us who their authors are. But Hebrews does not. Hebrews starts with God right from the very beginning, and we're going to say in a few minutes why that probably was. The early church fathers had mixed opinions about who the author of Hebrews was. Scholars in the eastern part of the Mediterranean, focused in Alexandria, Egypt, often suggested that Paul wrote the book, and as you know, in parts of the church early on, the book of Hebrews began to circulate with the Pauline epistles. Probably the reason for this was, among other things, the ending of Hebrews, which sounds very Pauline. You have some dynamics in Hebrews which do have connections with Paul's type of theology. But from the very beginning, you had scholars in the western part of the church who argued against that opinion, who said that this is not a book by Paul. And even those who held to Pauline authorship, like Clement of Alexandria, for instance, and Origen, recognized that the style of the book differs very sharply from Paul's writings. So even among those who said this is Pauline, recognize that the writing style of the book is not. It seemed to be something very, very different indeed. Today, very few scholars of any theological stripe hold to Pauline authorship of the book. Now, you do have a few exceptions here. David Black, who is at Southeastern Seminary, has given a lot of energy to kind of bringing this issue of Pauline authorship up again. I was involved in a symposium they had at Southeastern a few years ago in which David Black defended Pauline authorship and a guy named David Allen defended Luke's authorship. David Allen had done a dissertation on Luke as the author of Hebrews. And then they asked me to defend the Apollos position. And I said, well, I will defend someone like Apollos. I don't think we can be dogmatic about it. But here's the difficulty that I found in both of their approaches. Both of them took the approach of, here are all the parallels that you have between Hebrews and Paul. And so what David Black did is he lined all of those up. And you do have parallels in the way that the Old Testament is used at points and aspects of theology and specific terms and things like that. David Allen did the same thing with Luke. Look at all the parallels you have between Hebrews and Luke. Now, somebody tell me, what's the other question that you've got to ask, though, besides just lining up parallels to discern what's going on? What other question do you have to ask as you deal with that data where you see all these parallels between Luke and Hebrews or Paul and Hebrews? Somebody tell me.
The passages that aren't parallel.
All right, what are the differences? That's one thing. Yeah, why are the parallels there? What are some various possibilities? Well, sure, God could have just, he obviously inspired these things. Yeah, you might have a common background in terms of rhetoric, for instance, rhetorical kinds of training and education. You might therefore find certain types of rhetorical devices that they share. What else? Access to similar documents, broader religious background in the Jewish synagogue. That's absolutely right. That's the other question you've got to ask. Why do we have the parallels? Not just that there are. For instance, if the author of Hebrews was a person who was involved in Paul's mission in some way, you would expect that there would be a lot of overlap there in terms of the theology, for instance. And I asked them when we were out at that symposium, I said, look, you have over 30 exact parallels between Hebrews and 1 Peter. So do you think Luke also wrote 1 Peter? If you're going to just do it on the basis of parallels. No, you've got to ask that other question. What are other possible explanations for these parallels? Well, some of the main reasons why most do not hold to Pauline authorship are, number one, many of the book's images, theological motifs, and terms are not Pauline. Number one, many of the book's images, theological motifs, and terms are not Pauline. For example, You do not find Christ as high priest anywhere in the New Testament other than Hebrews. There are 169 words in Hebrews not found elsewhere in the New Testament. That's a lot of vocabulary. 169 words used in Hebrews not found elsewhere in the New Testament. So, the first reason why most suggest that Hebrews was not written by Paul was what? Theological motifs and the terminology. Yeah, that's the first reason. The second reason is the author does seem to use the Old Testament a bit differently than Paul. He introduces his quotations differently than Paul. What's the most common way that Paul introduces a quotation? It is written, ge graptai. But the author of Hebrews uses forms of legain to speak or to say. God says, the Holy Spirit says. And this is a common introduction that was used in sermons in the Greek Jewish synagogue sermons. So the author of Hebrews uses he says rather than it is written as his most common way of introducing a passage. So the first reason why most don't think it's Pauline was what? It has to do with the terms and theological motifs. The second was the different way of using what? The Old Testament quotations. And then thirdly, and this I think is fairly decisive in some way, the author of Hebrews depicts himself as having received the gospel from the original witnesses commissioned by the Lord. You find this in chapter 2, verse 3. The author of Hebrews depicts himself as having received the gospel from the original witnesses commissioned by the Lord. Chapter 2, verse 3. And Paul often makes assertions to the contrary. If you look at passages like Romans 1:1, 1 Corinthians 15:8, Galatians 1:11 through 16, that's Romans 1:1, 1 Corinthians 15:8, Galatians 1:11 through 16, you find over and over again Paul saying, I did not receive my gospel from those who are called apostles. He said, I received my gospel directly from the Lord. And so that seems to be a main assertion of Paul's. All right, through the centuries, there are other names that have been mentioned. And let me go through these, and we'll kind of take a section. I'll give you a chance to ask questions. Through the centuries, there have been other names like Luke, Clement of Rome, Barnabas, Jude, Apollos, Silvanus, and even Priscilla, which was put forward by Adolf von Harnack, for instance. The problem with Priscilla is in chapter 11, verse 32, you have the author using masculine forms there in referring to himself, and so it doesn't seem that that's probable, much less the fact that the author of Hebrews is using very, very advanced rhetorical techniques and had advanced education, as we'll say in a minute. It would be unlikely that a woman of that day would have attained to that level of education. Yeah, Hexen?
Could you just repeat those names?
Sure. You have people like Luke, Clement of Rome, Barnabas, Jude, Apollos, Silvanus, and Priscilla. Now, what do we know about the author of Hebrews from the book? Let me give you three main points. First of all, the author was a dynamic preacher. The author was a dynamic preacher who knew the Old Testament very, very well and was trained in the forms of interpretation common to the Jewish synagogue. The author was a dynamic preacher who really knew his Old Testament well, and he was trained in the forms of interpretation common in the Jewish synagogue. The book is just packed full of the Old Testament. You have somewhere around 35 quotations. 35 quotations in these 13 chapters. Another 34 allusions. And innumerable places where the author references some aspect of the Old Testament but doesn't give us a hint at the specific place he has in mind. And remember that with all of these quotations, it's improbable that the author had all of the scrolls right there at his fingertips. Remember that in this day and time, there were not chapter and verse divisions. There were not even spaces between the words. And so it's not like the author had a scroll of indices, you know. He called these things to mind because he had committed them to memory, I think, to a great extent. Now, I'm sure he had access to scrolls and at times would look at specific forms and things like that. But this is a person who was immersed in the Old Testament. It was second nature to him to talk in the language of the Old Testament. In fact, apart from the book of Revelation, there is no book of the New Testament that is more permeated with the Old Testament than the book of Hebrews. And of course, Hebrews does it quite differently than Revelation does. Revelation does not overtly quote. It goes forward mainly on allusions. So this person was a dynamic preacher. Most scholars today think that Hebrews was originally a sermon. Back in the 50s, a man named Hartwig Thyen, T-H-Y-E-N, did a book on the form of the Jewish synagogue homily, the Hellenistic, the Greek-speaking Jewish synagogue homily, and found that Hebrews, among other books, had a lot of characteristics in common with Jewish sermons of the day. Many scholars today think that Hebrews was not meant to be a letter like the other New Testament letters. It was crafted as a sermon and then had an epistolary ending attached to it so that it could be sent to the church. Secondly, not only was the author a great preacher, the author was highly educated, which in that day means that he had advanced training in rhetoric. In that day and time, when you studied rhetoric, what you studied was how to take traditional materials and bring it with force in a way that would convince an audience to do certain things. So the author uses lots of rhetorical devices. In fact, in the article that I gave you, Hebrews in its first century context, I list a whole bunch of specific rhetorical techniques that the author uses in crafting the book of Hebrews. As I was studying the structure of the book, it just amazed me how much effort the author put into crafting how this book would fit together and work. It was just incredible. And so here is a person who was highly, highly educated. The third point about the author, what we know about this author, is that the author served as a Christian leader of the church and exhibits a deep concern for the spiritual state of the book's recipients. The author served as a Christian leader of the church and exhibits a deep concern for the spiritual state of the book's recipients. What he does is he brings all of this rich background of training in the synagogue and training in the schools of rhetoric. He brings these to bear in the task of challenging this group of Christians to stay the course in living for Christ. Now, as I say in the commentary, any suggestion on the authorship of the book is a best guess. But I think the best guess is Apollos, which was originally suggested by Martin Luther. And the reason I say that is if you look at Acts chapter 18, verses 24 through 26, Acts 18, 24 through 26, Luke describes Apollos in this way. Meanwhile, a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the Scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue. So Apollos is someone who was, first of all, from Alexandria. We do see some parallels between Hebrews. In fact, quite a few verbal-type parallels, allusions in Hebrews to Philo of Alexandria. And we're going to say a little bit more about that when we talk about the background of the book in a minute. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a direct connection, because Philo was read throughout the Hellenistic world. And so that's not decisive in and of itself, but it is a connection. Secondly, Apollos was a learned man. The Greek term here is sometimes translated eloquent. It means a person who is highly educated in that day and time. And Alexandria was one of the primary centers for training in rhetoric in the day. Thirdly, Luke tells us that Apollos had a thorough grasp of the Scriptures, what we know of as the Old Testament, and that he spoke boldly with great fervor in the synagogue. In fact, Luke tells us that he strongly refuted the Jewish teachers of the day. So he was so powerful in his ability to argue from the Old Testament Scriptures that he strongly refuted others. Now, some, for instance, who have suggested that Barnabas or Luke might be the author of Hebrews need to consider this. When you look at how they are described in the book of Acts, you find Barnabas taking a back seat to Paul in terms of public proclamation. You never find Luke put forward as a powerful speaker. And it's kind of hard for me to imagine that they are the ones who have crafted this very powerful oratory we have in the book of Hebrews. Okay? So, these are some of the things that we know about the author. We cannot be dogmatic. We have to agree with Origen, who said, only God knows who wrote the book of Hebrews. But I would suggest that someone like Apollos wrote the book. When my friend and mentor Bill Lane died, at his funeral, his little grandson said, well, I guess Papa or Grandpa knows who wrote Hebrews now. It would be interesting to find out for sure. All right, do you have questions about the authorship of the book before we say just a brief word about the recipients? Yes.
When you were talking about him being well-trained, what you said in trained forms of interpretation, I thought you said
Yeah, we're going to see, and I'll even mention this in a few minutes, that Hebrews uses very clear, standard forms of dealing with the Old Testament in terms of interpreting the Old Testament. We're going to talk about the kind of guidelines given by Hillel that Paul uses. For instance, one of my professors, Earl Ellis, wrote a book about Paul's use of the Old Testament. But there's also been a good amount of work done about Hebrews' uses. And we're going to see, for instance, that the author uses an argument from lesser to greater, which was a common rhetorical kind of argument as well in the ancient world. But he uses verbal analogy, which was very common in the rabbis, where you take two Old Testament passages that have a common phrase or word, and you pull them together to interpret them in light of each other. And you have the author using a number of these types of techniques, which were very common to the religious arguments that were done in that day and time. So that's what I was referring to. It does seem that the author is not just, you know, just trained in rhetoric. The issues of worship and theology that come out in the book seem to be from one who has a real strong orientation to the synagogue, had kind of been in the synagogue, grown up in it, and that kind of thing. All right? Anybody else have a question? There. Yes, sir.
You mentioned baptized by John. Do you see any implications of that as far as theologically?
inferences. You're talking about in reference to Apollos? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I don't think that I said that he had been baptized by John, did I? You may be referring to the quote, the text there, in the quotation that you have in Acts 18. In terms of the connections, there are some in scholarship who have talked about the connections theologically between, you know, the book of John and the book of Hebrews, but of course you're dealing with a different John there. You're not dealing with John the Baptist in that sense. I think the significance of when he says that he knew only the baptism of John, it's interesting when you see these hints in Acts specifically about John's baptism, that John's ministry had a very broad impact that stayed, had staying power. You know, I mean, here we are several decades after the baptism of John, you know, John's ministry of baptism that we know about from the Gospels. And yet, evidently, he had a very broad impact on that part of the world. Luke's emphasis and the import of it here is simply that he had understood this call to repentance issued by John, but had not, and kind of the expectation of Messiah, but had not clearly grasped the implications of Jesus in the context of all that. So I don't, you know, there are some who want to make connections between John the Baptist and Qumran, and therefore, and they make connections with Hebrews and Qumran, and I don't think those approaches have been very productive, really. Okay? Let me say just a few words about recipients, and then we're going to take a break here. All right, in terms of the recipients of the book, let me give you several points, just like I did with authorship. So let's talk about the recipients here. First of all, these recipients seem to have a background in the synagogue as well. They seem to have a background in the Jewish synagogue. The author seems to assume a fairly broad understanding of the scriptures with this group. And he uses theological concepts that were popular in the Greek-speaking synagogues of the day. So kind of the heart of the point here is they seem to be people who have a background in the Jewish synagogue. An example would be a special veneration of Moses, angels as mediators of the law that you find there in 2, 1 through 4. Second, it seems that some have abandoned the Christian faith. Some from this community have abandoned the Christian faith and perhaps returned to mainstream Judaism. And others were struggling with the temptation to do so. Now, I don't want us to make a sharp distinction between Christianity and Judaism. Emergent early Christianity saw itself as Judaism. It was one of the Judaisms of the first century. So when we talk about returning to Judaism, that's not the way the early Christians would have thought of this. They would have thought of this as abandoning the proper form of Judaism and returning to an outdated form of it. This group seems to be struggling with abandoning the faith. Now, when we get to chapter 3 and then chapter 6, we're going to talk about what are the theological implications of all this? How do you think about someone in your church who has walked away from Christ? I mean, they were there, they seemed to be really involved in things, they seemed to be committed to the Lord, and 2 years later, they're gone. And not only are they gone, they, in essence, turn their back on the Christian faith as well. What do you do with that theologically? We're going to talk about that. All right, third, it's likely that the church addressed here is in the city of Rome. Perhaps a house church or a group of house churches, which is how the church in Rome seems to have functioned during this period. In that city of 1 million inhabitants, about 40 to 60,000 people were Jews. Remember that there were Jews from Rome at Pentecost. And I think how the church at Rome was founded was not in one of the standard mission trips, but by those who were at Pentecost going back home to Rome and starting the church there. Hebrews 13:24. The author writes, "Those from Italy send you their greetings." The most natural way to understand that phrase, "from Italy," although that's ambiguous, is to understand it as referring to folks who are from Rome but away from there at the time. So in other words, the author of Hebrews is writing back to Rome and saying, those who are with me who are from Italy, Rome specifically, send you their greetings. A second point in favor of a Roman destination is that the earliest documented use of Hebrews in the early church is in 1 Clement, which was written by Clement of Rome. So it was first quoted in a book from the end of the first century, which had its origin in the city of Rome. A third point in favor of Roman destination is Hebrews uses a term, leaders, hegumenoi, leaders, to refer to those who govern the church. Doesn't use elders or overseers, which are the most common terms in the New Testament. He uses the term leaders. And this is the designation for church leadership that you find in 1 Clement and the Shepherd of Hermas, both of which were associated with the church at Rome. So I think Hebrews was originally written to a Jewish Christian community in the city of Rome, and it had members struggling with enduring in their Christian commitment. Yes?
If it were originally a sermon, perhaps, that was constructed, would you then say it was probably a sermon constructed for Roman Christian Jews off somewhere and then, you know, not in Rome necessarily, and then written?
Yeah, my guess is that the author crafted this sermon specifically with the Roman Christians in mind. He was away from the community for a time. But remember, the oral presentation of documents was the common form of the way things were presented in that day and time. So not being able to get back to them, it would not have been an unusual thing for you to craft a presentation to send back to be presented to them to address their situation. So I think that the author had a lot of ministry among them, was away at the time, detained, and not able to get back, and we'll see that at the end of the book, and then crafted this with the purpose of sending back to have a specific impact on their community. Yeah?
The reasons you give for the believers likely being in Rome, are those all from kind of the appendage on the end that could be added to the sermon? Could it have been that it was addressed to any believer struggling in general and then was just sent to Rome? And are those verses coming from the end of the book?
Yeah, the difficulty with that, that's a good point. There have been people in the past who've said that the end of the book is really, you know, just kind of attached on the end as something separate. There's a very good book that deals with the unity of the book and specifically with that ending of the book that shows that it's really one with the rest of the book, that you have all these thematic links with the rest of the book. And the other thing is, you have throughout the book of Hebrews these very personal addresses, like in 10, chapter 32 and following, remember the former days when you stood strong in the faith and stood with those who were being imprisoned and that kind of thing. And so those very personal types of addresses, to me, mean that it was not crafted as just kind of a general address to people under persecution, probably, that it was meant to address this specific community.
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church. And it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 28428, Spokane, Washington, 99228, USA.